Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. Can we please start with you saying your name, where you work, and what you do in your job?
I'm Thomas Serbrücken. I'm an associate administrator of science. That means that I lead the agency's science programs here at NASA. That's what I do each and every day. So there's basically two things. The first one is, of course, to deal with the missions, close to 100 missions that are there, many of them in flight, many of them under development, and some of them being launched in the next couple of years. And then in addition to that, of course, setting the science strategy with inputs from the national academies, from the science community as a whole.
So how does the science you and your team do here at NASA influence society?
We're leading science in and from space in the world here at NASA. Basically, by any account, it's a leading program for both earth science, for planetary sciences, astrophysics, and for heliophysics, which is solar and space physics, as referred to by others. We're leading the program, and I really believe that the responsibility that we feel is really heavy for us, in a sense that we recognize that as the leaders, we set the speed of exploration right now. So if we look back from the future, next 100 years, kind of the speed at which we went here in this time in history was strongly set by us. And so as leaders, we think about that very, very strongly. We recognize, of course, that leadership and collaboration are not opposing values. We believe that part of our leadership is to bring others along. Look at the Earth, the most beautiful planet we've ever seen. And we know right now is a planet that, of course, we inhabit, all of us. And kind of whatever happens here, whatever we observe with our U.S. satellite may have the best, the most important impact in Nepal, the most important impact in Africa, or in China, or anywhere else on Earth. It may also be in North Dakota, right here at home. So basically what we do, both with our measurements but also with our policies, we make sure that the societal impact is maximized. We keep learning new ways of doing that, for example, partnering with both non-for-profits and for-profits to take the data out and make it available, whether it's with companies such as Google and Microsoft or others, Amazon, or whether it's with companies that are kind of providing aid to communities that cannot afford such things. We try to make our data work here on Earth science. For the other disciplines, of course, the way we affect society is very profound as well, and that is we don't only change what we know about nature, but how we think about ourselves. That's fundamentally, not only in Earth science, but in all disciplines, how we think. We look at the night sky today, we see more in that night sky than my parents did. We see more, not because there's other dots, it's because there's other stars and so forth. It's because we know what they mean. We know how each one of the stars, for example, has on the average a planet. We did not know that even when I was a kid. The best scientists did not know that. It's our missions that teach us that. And I could continue thinking about Jupiter. Of course, we think of Jupiter, we think of Saturn, but we think about these moons that are barely discernible by naked eye, and we think of them as potential places where life can arise. And so for us, that's what we do. So we change society by making us think of ourselves and our place in nature, not just by the direct impact on Earth and our lives in a very direct fashion like Earth science does.
Can you tell me more about your day-to-day role as the Associate Administrator of the Science Mission Directorate?
So my day-to-day role is one of a leader of an excellent team. The most important part of that sentence is the team, right? It's too hard to run a program. Right now it's around $7 billion per year. So it's one of the largest programs of any kind in science anywhere on Earth. And so the only way you do that, of course, is not because you're kind of an amazing leader yourself. It's that the most important part is that as a leader, you're supposed to do is get an amazing team, a team that is empowered to go out there and lead those missions and actually make decisions and think about options that, frankly, I could not think about all by myself, the better decisions than I would make by myself. excellent teams is what makes fantastic missions happen, not some individual. And so that's how I should think about it. So the vast majority of my meetings that I have, the vast majority of my decisions that we make are in a team context. This morning, for example, we decided on a number of phase A studies. So those are lucky principal investigators and teams that send us proposals, and they're going to get a phone call in the next 10 days, and they know that they're getting funding for a year or so to take ideas that they've proposed to us and show whether they're actually ready for flight. One or two of them will be selected for flight. So that will be the next mission. So, of course, I made the decision at the end, but I did so by listening to what were about 25 people in a room. So that's very symptomatic of that. Frankly, the decision was brought forward by a set of experts. They themselves talked to something like 50 to 100 people looking both at technology and science. And that was put forward to me in the room with the experts there. So that's just one decision this morning for 2 hours. In addition, today I've met already with a NASA center director, with their management teams. We talked about five of the missions that we're doing. I'm later on going to talk to individuals, both companies, but also individuals who are leading the missions here. And in addition to that, on a normal day, also perhaps talk to Congress or the science community. So those are the days. Again, the most important part about it is the most important task is to build a team that actually gets the information in a way that we can make the right decisions.
Excellent. And I'd love to hear more about the missions in just a little bit, but I was hoping we could go back to your childhood and your past. Are there any particular scientific events that grabbed your attention and influenced your decision to become a scientist?
So for me, it always starts with the night sky. I'm an astrophysicist by training, and the way you become an astrophysicist, the way I became an astrophysicist, with the understanding that the night sky is important. And you can see that. It's like many people have the same feeling when they look at mountains, which of course were also very much available where I grew up in the Swiss mountains, but also at the sky. Some people feel that way when they look at desert or the sea. It's a sense of an immense awe that is there. Nature is the most beautiful thing we could look at, right? Besides, of course, the human connections and that are so rich, enriching for us too. It's nature that makes us think beyond us. And so for me, it was always that, the ability of learning about it. And of course, I learned all the constellations and, you know, with my map on top of the roof in Switzerland. In a family which did not do science or engineering, I did not know a single scientist or engineer. But I was part of public school. I actually got really amazing teacher. And the reason I decided to study science is because I learned in a physics class about the Copernican Revolution. And the way I think about it, it's the power of knowledge to change how we think as humanity. I already talked about that earlier. That's what we do every day. We hear with the Hubble Space Telescope, James Webb, that we're just announcing is actually put together as a single observatory. So it's these kind of amazing things, the Parker Solar Probe that's flying deep through the sun right now as we speak, through the solar corona. It's those kind of breakthrough observatories that make us change how we think. So it's that moment in that classroom, I remember I basically said, I want to be a scientist. And I couldn't figure out which type of science because I was always interested in all science. I took physics just because I felt it was a fundamental science among all sciences. Because it's all physics kind of camouflage, you know, chemistry is physics of, you know, atoms that don't like to be alone, you know, and then if you add much chemistry, all of a sudden it starts crawling around. We don't know why, by the way, that transition from complex chemistry to biology, we don't understand, but it's there and so forth. So science is what it was. So it's really the night sky, and it's the recognition in that class that knowledge of nature can change how humanity charts its way forward.
And going from, you know, having that moment in your classroom, do you have specific stories from your career that stand out to you? Perhaps other moments where you discovered something new or inspiring?
I think the most important part that any researcher will ever have is an experience that basically is a moment in time when you learn something as a researcher nobody else knows on Earth. As a researcher in your office, at my time, it was 3 a.m., I believe. I tended to work late before I had kids. So at 3 a.m., I understood something about the sun. Nobody else did at that moment in time. And I remember how that felt. Of course, what I learned later on is many of these moments are followed by moments where that whole recognition is falsified. It's like, okay, so it's not that easy. And I learned that science is, research is all about search. So there's a lot of dead ends in research. It's a very patient activity to do research. It's one that is very entrepreneurial, very kind of welcoming of defeat, in a sense. If you cannot survive that, you're not a researcher, right? It's a very humbling experience because most of the time you're wrong, and it's all about being able to ask any and all questions, no matter how uncomfortable that may be for me right now, and actually answering the questions not by yelling at somebody, but by the tools of science, which of course were developed over centuries. And so for me, that first moment of finding out something, in this case, where a particular type of solar wind came from, originated on the sun, when I figured that out, I just was elated. I've had many moments like that since in my 200-plus publications. There's probably 20 such moments. It's not 200. The vast majority of them are smaller steps. But every once in a while, you have a leap. That's just kind of a recognition. You get addicted to that. And what I realized, there's actually people who are much better at this than I am. I'm pretty good, but there are people who are much better. It's important to recognize when there's others. And I realized, hey, if I support them, actually together we find out more things than if I just spend all my time creating those moments for me. So if I want to maximize the number of such moments, you support the others. That's what I recognize for myself, because I get how to build teams much better than many of the others. And so basically, if I bring that to the table, together we're a better team.
I'm glad you brought up the topic of defeat. What have been some of your greatest career challenges that you've faced?
So there's probably nobody in this building that has lost more proposals than me. And by the way, that helped me a lot. What happens, I just talked about the three principal investigators being selected at the end. There will be one that goes forward. I will call that winner, and I will also call the losers because I know how it feels to be on the other side. So I can bring empathy to that call. I can bring to that call the recognition that loss is part of going forward. So I've lost any and all things. I've lost an instrument that was supposed to go to the moon without any weaknesses. By the way, the reason for it was that it didn't have space on a spacecraft because of a launch vehicle. After they told me 2 weeks later that they took a bigger launch vehicle. So I was on missions to Mars. By the way, I've won a few too. I went to Mercury with an instrument. My team built just an amazing first measurement of the exosphere of that planet. Build instruments that look at the sun right now as we speak. Some of them are pretty old now. Some of them are going to launch next year. And so basically, I've won a few, but I've lost a lot of them, probably between 10 or so proposals that were really highly rated and for which, in some cases, I've put a year or even more into. And so that was a critical experience. Defeats, kind of, if it comes to the experience of research, if it comes to doing innovation and entrepreneurial things, defeat is part of it. Losing is part of it. It's not some kind of extraordinary thing that will happen. It's the confidence in doing it comes from making it through these defeats and these losses and coming out the other end stronger.
Do you have a moment in your life when you realized that science transformed something around you?
I think I already talked to you about the historic moment where I recognized that. Of course, since then, I've observed it everywhere. I'm a reader of history. I'm a reader of psychology, for example, of philosophy and other things. And so you can track it throughout. Of course, in my life personally, if you build space instruments, which is what I did, it is the application of science and math that makes a space instrument. And it transforms your career. It transforms your understanding. What's so great about space science is the ability that not only it is at the heart of many of the questions that we've puzzled about as in the realm of philosophy for millennia. But it's also the place where we now know how to build the instruments and the machines that can answer those with the tools of science. So there's nothing more empowering, in my opinion, than being able to build an instrument that at the end sends data down that answers a historic question, like, are we alone? Where did the universe start? Where are we going? What's the Earth's destiny? Can we save lives from storms? It's these kind of things that we address each and every day. So yes, I see it. I mean, many, too many to count. But it's really the application of science, both on the modeling side, but then really pulling it together in an interdisciplinary team that makes a space instrument of the type that we do here.
What gives you the most satisfaction in your career here?
I think the moment when you run over the finish line as a team is one of the moments that you'll never forget in your life, and you get addicted to it. You have to figure out what kind of person you are. I actually know people that rather go over finish lines by themselves. I also know people that make sure just when you come into the final stretch, they let the team fall behind. So it looks like they made it themselves, and they don't want anybody else to take the credit. I think that's foolish. Because we all know, and anybody who's an observer of excellence understands that nobody can do it by themselves. Sometimes it's good for somebody to be the speaker or the kind of head of an organization, kind of more, especially if it's very, very risky, because then that person can take the negative feedback when it's come. But for me, that feeling of arriving, whether it's a launch or a first data set, whether it's a first breakthrough, sharing that with the team and kind of knowing what went in it and how many people how many people actually put their heart and soul into it for that to go. I think that is always a very important moment that you know, I really have the most excitement of. I'm kind of, by the way, those people include members of Congress. Those people include people at OMB. Many people talk negatively about them, but I think of them as team members because they need to be convinced, just the same way as our scientists, that what we're doing is important, and the taxpayers as well, who do this. We talk very often about the taxpayer in a room. You know, basically the question is, does what we do make sense? They're part of that too. So that's why it's important to recognize that, you know, we do this together, and I'm excited to kind of win those victories with all of them.
Looking forward into the future, what do you hope the geosciences will help humanity understand in the next 50 years?
I think if you look back 50 years and you look to where we are right now and you advance 50 years, the first thing you do is you get scared a little bit. And part of it, of course, has to do with the just impact that we have as humans on this planet. Part of it, of course, is unknown. We should never go state to the public that we know everything about the Earth. I think some of our science colleagues are hurting science by overstating what they know. For example, the measurements of the ice shields of the Arctic and the Antarctic at the accuracy that we need, we're measuring right now. We measured that since last year. For the first time, we have of the order spatial resolution of 1 meter, high resolution of 2 to 3 millimeters, which is what it takes to actually measure ice accurately. We only have those data, really globally, for a year or so. It was not the case before the spatial resolution, except for punctual places where we flew over with airplanes. Spatial resolution was closer to 100 meter the altitude resolution closer to 3 to 5 centimeters. So the accuracy improvement of on ice, you want to understand the ice story, you need to measure it better. So for me, as we go forward the next 50 years, the measurements will have to be better. In addition to that, I think where we're going is not a discussion in which we basically argue with each other in a political domain mostly. Not in any other domain really, but in a political domain, whether some kind of impacts of nature are real or not. It's about how we survive them, how we thrive as a society in a environment that we have affected over the last decades or so, and that many of the impacts are still coming our way, and we don't know yet what they are. We're horrible at predicting impacts. We're horrible. I mean, it's to me, you know, I mean, we can't even on a timescale of a year reliably predict big impacts. I mean, frankly, you know, there's important things we don't understand, and we should be scientists in all of these. This is what we do. So geophysics, the sciences that we do, will be as they are today, but even more so, an enabling and ever-present activity that will affect many parts of our lives that right now it's not. So right now what affects our lives, it's the weather forecast. Will there be many other elements of that? You know, my daughter has asthma. How can the environment that, of course, has pollutants and has organisms that are out there, kind of particulates that are floating around, how can we help her make sure that she knows I need to be careful and perhaps not go to a massive run and then deal with asthma attacks? Every one of us will have those. But then macroscopic things, how do we turn around some of these trends that are frightening, and not just for us, but for our children? So for me, the next 50 years will be all about living with those changes as opposed to trying to convince stakeholders that whether or not these changes are there. So it will be more important, not less important than they are today.
And how does NASA act as a leader for these problems in the face of such uncertainty?
We take uncertainty off the table. Mm-hmm. Our job at NASA is actually not to lead the policy discussion. That's not what we do. Our job is to make the measurements that take the uncertainty off the table. Let's go measure where the CO2 actually comes from. Not just the factory. Every one of us, it's not that hard. I used to do it with my students. You know, you can go put the CO2 in a pollution measurement next to a factory. That's not, okay, fine. I mean, there's all agencies and there's regulatory regimens for that. But the question is, as a planet, you know, where are these, you know, where's the CO2? Where also are pollutants coming from? Many of these things are natural, right? And so we have spacecraft in orbit right now that make for the first time these both spatially and temporally resolved measurements. Of course, it's much more complicated. It's just not that simple. There's a science result right now that's really puzzling, and that is if you look at the wind, you know, of course, there's a preferred direction because the Earth goes around, the trade winds are one way around the Earth, right? So if you look at these trade winds and you look at the CO2, if you look at what's coming in over California and you measure what's coming off the East Coast, do you realize that the CO2 coming off the East Coast is smaller than the CO2 going in from the West Coast? That's a paper suggests that it is the case. Well, how do we, is that, so first of all, is that correct? Well, science is falsifiable. That's why we need to go check and do it with higher resolution. We have a mission to do that we're working on right now. But if it was correct, that kind of undercuts the argument that the U.S. is the major reason for CO2 in the atmosphere, right? Because kind of it should, why would that be the case? Of course, we all recognize it's a three-dimensional problem, not a two-dimensional or one-dimensional like I just made it. But that gives you pause. Well, scientists struggle with that. They don't just snap to solutions. My biggest worry is that as we educate the next generation of scientists, geoscientists, that we make them great scientists who can talk about their science in a way that society understands, not in some kind of university dark hole that only five people on Earth are ever interested in it. It's kind of let's go talk about it. So we scientists understand, but they behave like scientists. So in other words, what they say, they will not react to like some religious fanatic. They will be okay taking questions and kind of making sure examining what's out there is right, no matter what it is. So we take ambiguity off the table. So it's easier for decision makers, it's easier for society to actually recognize where they need to act. As a private citizen, of course, I make decisions on how I vote, how I make decisions going forward. I hope that our geophysicists do the same. And they talk to their neighbors, too, about their science. So it's not just about a pursuit that you do during 9 to 5. It's kind of an all-in activity. That's what science or kind of activities of the type that we do here really are that way. They're not just like 9 to 5 type of activities, because we study the very foundation of being, our Earth.
You have many missions underway right now. Can you bring out one that you're excited about going forward?
I can talk about many, of course. Let me take one. I'm going to take what is the most trivial mission. I just want to talk about it. It's Landsat 9. So for me, Landsat is kind of in many ways a mission that in this case has new capabilities as compared to previous Landsats. But what's special about it, what we care about together with our USGS partners, is that it's a continuation of a series of measurements that's over 40 years. So basically what happens with this mission that we're putting together right now, and frankly we're getting into final testing kind of before the end of this year, this mission, of all the missions, I would argue, will have the most societal impact because of the fact that literally billions of people depend on the measurements that come down all around the world. So just imagine that, you know, that mission being put together by our friends at Goddard Space Flight Center, by the companies around, whether it's Northrop, whether it's other companies that are there and are launching it, right? That mission, together with our international partners, in this case, ESA and JAXA, provides a framework of measurements that best tracks our evolution of this Earth. So we actually see deforestation. It's not a question whether some minister in some country somewhere on Earth believes data or not. Let's go take an image. The same is true with China and pollution. The same is true with the U.S. and pollution. The same is true with Africa. What is happening on this Earth? I think Landsat, of all the missions we have, if you looked at it in the 50-year timescale, will have most to do with how healthy my children, grandchildren are here on Earth.
Can you discuss scientific questions that Landsat helps answer?
So the first question, of course, that's at the heart of it is how we utilize land, how we utilize our resources. We will have many different re-image a given scene at, in most cases, 30-meter resolution, but re-image it in multiple colors so we can actually look at, for example, crop yields, or we can look at the evolution of forests all around the world. So effectively what Landsat does through that is really help us understand how the Earth itself shifts under its entire, for example, relative to farming, relative to its natural resources, shifts under its changing environments. The climate timescales are decadal timescales. They're not, people miss that sometimes, they're not daily, or just because it's hot today does not mean that the climate increases in temperature. We have to look at this over the decadal timescale. So it's we recognize, looking from the sky, that these things are shifting, that farming today, for example, I used to live in Michigan. Michigan really benefits from climate change in an enormous fashion. So first of all, the weather is nicer, but the second thing is the farming yields are enormously up. Well, for any Michigan, there are other states that then deal with the other issue in which Landsat helps, which is water. So kind of Western water, water in the South, is a really important discussion that, frankly, you know, Landsat helps us understand, together with other assets in this case, because we actually look below the surface of where water is, kind of evapotranspiration, you know, of plants. How healthy are they? Are they stressed before they turn brown? I remember in Switzerland, I always looked at the valley across. And so basically, you know, the whole grass turns brown. You know, we're in trouble. It hasn't rained for a long time. Well, it's too late then. The grass really has damage. So those hills, they do not produce as much for the cattle that want to eat those grass. Well, what we see now with our measurements, long before it turns brown, how are the plants doing going forward? So it's that kind of measurement that looks at, again, the water resources, of course, that we all use, not just the plants, but all of us use for survival. So that's another element, as there are many more.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Zurbuchen, to have you here with us. I want to end with a final question. How do you see yourself contributing to the future of science?
I see myself contributing as a public servant. It's not so important that at the end, my name is the most important and people remember. You know, it would be easier to have a different name to remember in a complex name like mine. It's hard. What's important is that together, that this country, through this agency and otherwise, really continues to add important value to the world as a whole, not only from the point of view of understanding, but also from the point of view of reacting to those data in a way that shows wisdom, shows foresight, and shows determination to leave this world better for the next generation than we took it when we were young.